Mr. Tasky. The Antic Files. Episode 2.
Welcome back to my experimental podcast, Inversitasky, The Antic Files.
It reminds me of The X-Files.
This episode features Volume 1, Number 2, which was June of 1982. The subject of this issue is communications. The price for Antic on this issue was $2.50. 1 year is $15. Now 2 years is only $27, or $85.25 today. So you get a small savings for the double-year subscription. This issue is 56 pages cover to cover, and there are 26 different advertisers in it. On the news front, this issue has a focus on communications, as I mentioned and as you will hear. Today, there are several options for connecting your Atari to bulletin boards without having to have a phone line and without having to endure 300 baud. While there may be others, I'll mention a couple I know of that work well in no preferred order. FujiNet, this is an SIO device that brings many functions to your Atari 8-bit. At its core, it connects your Atari to a Wi-Fi network. One function of the device is the R device, or modem, emulation. This allows you to dial BBSs, or bulletin boards, running on real hardware that are connected to the internet, typically through Telnet or raw TCP connections. FujiNet does also have printer and disk emulation, and generally provides a lot of functionality the Atari was never designed to do. Another option is the Y-Modem 232. This is from CBM Stuff. This is an RS-232 device that connects to Wi-Fi as well. The key difference between this and FujiNet is this is a modem only and emulates the Hayes command set, so it acts like a real modem. It does require you to have a serial expansion for your 8-bit, but it is an excellent option if you only need a modem. You can get this with and without an OLED screen that shows connection status, etc. And I have both of these and recommend them both. There are links to them in the show notes. I was curious to see how the first episode was received. I got some feedback, which I'll talk about later on, and I appreciate those that did send it in, so thank you. I pulled stats from my hosting provider. Of the two recent episodes, Inversitasky MTS Software Write 80 and Inversitasky The Antic Files Episode 1, in November alone, the Write 80 episode had 422 downloads. At number 2 in the list is the Antic Files episode with 395 downloads. It seems like the reach is about the same there. I then opened up the stats to cover the entire run of the podcast way back to 2014, and the top two spots have incredible numbers at 5,783 and 4,849. Those are for the GT Estate Word Processor and GT Albert E Spreadsheet, respectively. Those are amazing stats considering those episodes were only released this year and garnered the top two spots with significant numbers. Then there are a couple of episodes in the 2000s range and a couple in the 1000s range, and this is all downloads. The recent episode on cut and paste is number 7 with 943 downloads. Then I was stunned to see the Antic Files episode 1 at number 8 with 868 downloads. These stats were pulled only 2 weeks after the episode's release, and I never expected to see it make the top 10 of all time. Wow. Thank you all. This helps me decide to keep going, and I'll monitor the stats for a while to see if it wanes with any subsequent episodes. The cover for this issue is a large Earth globe. There is an Atari 830 modem diagonally across the United States, and a purple telephone handset connected to the acoustic coupler portion. Above the globe, which would be deep space, is kind of a pinkish-purplish color, and in large letters, Antic appears, all in black, with the Atari resource underneath. In the upper right corner, it has the volume information and the price, and in the bottom right corner, it says communications in dark black text. One thing to note about the acoustic coupler, there are red, yellow, and blue lines streaming down from both couplers down to the earth. The editorial in this issue is rather small. It mainly introduces the I.O. board section, which is reader feedback and questions. Let's talk about a few ads. The first ad in here is a full-color, bright yellow page with highlighted text in heavy red font and black text. Did you figure it out yet? It's for Elephant Memory Systems, an iconic ad, and I'm sure you all remember it. Next, Datasoft has a full-color ad for four new products. It has an Atari 800 and monitor on an art easel. The color monitor is displaying an image of an old car against a backdrop of trees and a sky. It states a graphic masterpiece has arrived at your fingertips. The programs advertised are MicroPainter, Graphics Generator, Graphic Master, and Color Print. They require 32K to 48K and are priced from $24.95 to $39.95, and today that is $78.78 to $126.14. Graphic Master in particular was featured on Inversitaski Season 4, Episode 8, and there's a link in the show notes. There's also an ad for Haze, which is a full-color ad for the Smart Stack. This has the hand-drawn schematic feel to it, where the modem is on top of the chronograph, both drawn but in full color and near-picture quality. It's titled Smart Modem. The ultimate concept in modems is now a reality. I really wanted one of these modems and the clock combination back in the day, but this wasn't in the cards for me being in high school. They were just a little too expensive. LJK also has a full page monochrome ad featuring Letter Perfect, Data Perfect, Edit 6502, and the Disk Utility, as well as the Mail Merge Utility. I mentioned in the last episode that Letter Perfect was featured on Inversitaski. I neglected to mention that episode includes an interview with the founder, Ken Leonardi. There's a link in the show notes. Bit3 also has a half-page monochrome ad. It details the features of their FullView 80 display card, which gives your Atari 80 columns as well as their 32K Memory Plus card. The FullView 80 is priced at $349, which is $1,102 today. That's pretty expensive. And the last ad that drew my eye was one from Compute Publications, which is a full-page ad. It features Compute's first book of Atari, Inside Atari DOS by Bill Wilkinson, and of course, Compute Magazine. The feature list in this second issue is a little bit larger, and it's much closer to what I remember. The first feature is Modems by John Lovelace, and this article describes what a modem is, what types of modems there are, some terminology you should be familiar with, and what some different features do and why you might be interested in them.
Here is looking at you, auto dial, auto answer.
He also gives you a short summary of three different modems, the Atari 830, the Micro Peripheral Corp Micro Connection A, and the Haze Smart Modem. He even includes a small paragraph on BBSs and why you might want to call one. The next feature is called Dialing for Data by Robert DeWitt. This article discusses communication networks such as CompuServe and The Source. It talks about availability, cost, and what information they offer, such as news. Apparently, you could shop online via The Source, and I didn't know that. It also talks about core functions like email and chat. I didn't know that CompuServe had a 10 email limit, but that's not really surprising to me because I didn't really use email on CompuServe when I had it. There were also bulletin boards, but not like BBSs. These are like the old cork bulletin boards that you would find all over a college campus, for example. And of course, he discusses SIGs, or special interest groups, which is what I used most when I was on CompuServe. Speaking of CompuServe, did you know that CompuServe dated back to 1969? It was a database service for other companies and government, and it was owned by H&R Block. In 1982, it was using DEC 10 mainframe computers and all had about 20,000 subscribers. The next feature is Communication Software by John Lovelace. This article gives a new modem user some essential terminology, as well as an overview and comparison chart for six terminal programs, including Atari Telelink, Swifty Software's Datalink, and Computer Age's Download, as well as APX's Chameleon, and T-Smart from Micro Peripheral Inc., and last, THE from Binary Computers. Overall, Swifty's Datalink is recommended. The next feature is called Assembly Language by Jerry White. This article presents a utility written in BASIC, which creates an assembly routine that can be called from your program to fill a portion of memory with a value. You might want to do this to clear the screen or player missile memory areas. The BASIC source includes a demo which has three modes. It displays a description and menu and plays a little sound before accepting your choice. Each option plays a start sound, runs through repeatedly filling the screen with characters from the character set while changing colors, and it has an end ding. The options are presented here, and listen up. The first is Fast with Sound, which completes in about 1 minute 12 seconds. Then there is Very Fast with Sound, which completes in about 22 seconds. And there is That's Incredible, Silent, which completes the sequence in 9 seconds. I gotta say, I am impressed with the display speed from BASIC using this routine, especially on the very fast and silent modes. The next feature is called The Starting Line by Robert DeWitt. This article is a rudimentary primer into using the screen editor. It talks about what the cursor is, why the screen wraps around, how to use the cursor movement controls, and inserting or deleting characters. This stuff is for the absolute beginner, as in you've never seen a computer before. Just open the box and don't know where to start. You'll likely change the sample program to print your name instead of "This is an example of Atari screen editing capabilities," and the article includes a short glossary of terms as well. The next feature is called Tari Talkers by Ken Harms, and that's not Atari Talkers, it's Tari Talkers, apostrophe T-A-R-I. This article starts as a bit of sci-fi narrative, then discusses the matter at hand. Speech synthesizers. Two specifically, Type and Talk from Votrax and Echo GP from Street Electronics. Both of these devices need an 850 or compatible interface and a serial cable. The Votrax also needs a speaker. He shows you how to build the serial cable needed, He also discusses an experiment he did asking FAIR users to listen to 20 words from each and state which they understood better. He thought the Votrax would win, but the Echo GP apparently sounded better to most people. In addition, he gives some tips for getting them to sound words out correctly.
I do not have that problem. I can pronounce anything with 99.99999% accuracy.
Yes, speech synthesis has come a long way. The next feature is called Tricks of the Trade by Stan Aukers. This article deals with game programming. The subject is using machine language and the vertical blank interrupt to accomplish smooth movement of player missiles, update counters, etc. A program called Crash Tinkle Tinkle is presented to demonstrate the game has two players, and the idea is to stop a baseball from hitting a window. Points are earned by the balls ending proximity to the window. The next feature is called Pilot Your Atari by Ken Harms. This article tells you how to use graphics modes 1 and 2 from Pilot. Pilot apparently only has built-ins for modes 0 and 7. I typed it in, but it didn't tell me how to run it. I guessed with "Are you in?" and it worked. I got it to successfully display text in modes 1 and 2 with two different colors, a step beyond what is taught, but the program crashed when returning to the graphics mode 0, specifically on the close command, which is identical to the previous close commands. Not being a Pilot expert, I just saved my work, which I had to look up as well, and there are some screenshots of this on the website. The next feature is called In the Public Domain by Dave Plotkin and Maria Montes. This article features a basic game called Attack of the Death Star. The next article is called Systems Guide by James Caparel. This article is a continuation of the previous issue. It completes the memory map for page 0 memory addresses. Then it jumps to page 2 memory addresses with a continuation due in the next issue. The next feature is Pascal by Frederick and Frederick. This article introduces the reader to Pascal programming language, specifically Atari Pascal, as available through APX. The article is less instructional and more of an overview. It does include a sample program that demonstrates a display list change. It does not tell you how to compile and link it. I figured this out just by running the Pascal program on disk 1, and compilation and linking does involve some disk swapping. I tried to get it to run under SpartaDOS and MyDOS, but was unsuccessful in both efforts, so Atari DOS it is. The example program wouldn't compile, then I realized it was missing the first line, which defines it as a program. After that, it compiled and then linked successfully, however, it failed to run. I finally got it to run, at least I think I did, and there is no description of what the output should be other than it is from Dayray Atari and is a scrolling demo. The only way I could run it was from within the Pascal program using the run option. When it ran, it changed to Graphics 2 and scrolled Program Source across the screen from left to right. There are some screenshots on the website. The next feature is GTIA by Tim McGinnis. This article describes the new GTIA chip, which stands for Graphic Television Interface Adapter, and describes its differences with the CTIA, or Color Television Interface Adapter. There are three new modes, Graphics 9, 10, and 11, and this explains the capabilities. If you bought the machine near the time of the switch, he tells you how to determine if you have the GTIA or CTIA. And interestingly, it describes Graphics 0 as test mode. I've always referred to it as the normal mode. There are some sample programs here as well to demonstrate. The first draws kind of a shooting star from the top left to the bottom right in Graphics mode 9. The next is the same, but in Graphics 11 with a rainbow effect. The next one draws four multicolor cylinders, then rotates the colors to make them look like they are spinning. And the last one draws random color lines in Graphics Mode 11, and there are screenshots on the website. A note about Tim, he is a design engineer in corporate research and development for Atari. The last feature in this issue is called Fourth Factory by Bob Gonzalez. This article subject is utilities. In it, Bob presents some fourth definitions that provide some useful utilities. I know absolutely nothing about fourth. It's not a language that I was ever required to learn, nor crossed my radar at any point in time. I thought about trying some of the code, but it may as well be written in a foreign language. I don't understand it. I may have to skip any fourth articles in the future, other than trying to provide a synopsis based on the intro of the content.
If you were truly devoted, you would go learn fourth, then come back to this.
Let me put this in terms you might understand. I don't have the cycles for it, even though fourth may be a great language. Got a little miscellany to talk about. First, they fixed the typo in the publication information section at the front of the magazine. It now reads ANTIC instead of just NTIC. Next, there is a note in the back that user groups could get one free subscription to Antic in exchange for a subscription to their club's newsletter. On page 35, there is a small paragraph titled "When the Chips Are Down." It states that the operating system revision B was released in January. It then gives instructions for how to determine which version you have, which is a simple peek into location 58383. If the value is 56, you have revision A. A value of 0 means you have revision B. In the new product section, there is a blurb for The Block by Protronix. This is a cart that is designed to copy other carts to disk. Back in the mid-80s, I managed to borrow one from a friend who had borrowed it from another friend. I could never get it to work, even on a simple 8K cart. The trickery with inserting it while the computer is on always seemed to hung up the computer for me. I couldn't get it right, or my 800 just wouldn't cooperate. And last, also in the new products section, is a blurb about the Fast Chip by Newell Industries. I didn't have this, but one of my friends did, and I remember we ran some math tests on both of our machines, and his was indeed faster. Coincidentally, FastChip, with a dash, by Binary Corp. is also listed. This is stated to speed up the 810 disk drive by 30% on older units and 10% on newer units while formatting. What's this? Tucked away here in the back is an interview. It's with Rob Sherman from the Southern Amos Projects. You might know him as Amos from Southern Amos BBS or SouthernAmos.com, or on social media as Atari BBS. Rob restores, preserves, and runs Atari bulletin board systems, which support a growing community of enthusiasts. If you've logged into an Atari BBS recently, chances are good you've experienced some of his work. There's a link in the show notes to the main Southern Amos project page. Now, let's have a listen to what the interview has in store for us. I am interviewing Rob Sherman from Southern Amos Projects. So Rob is the caretaker of many BBS projects and restoration of several BBSs in the Atari 8-bit world. And maybe, Rob, you would like to step in and explain the Amos representation.
Yeah, the Amos side of the Southern Amos projects, actually the Southern Amos piece together, is reference to my 1984 endeavor into BBSing on the Atari A8. That was the name of the first board that we actually built. So coming out of 35 plus years of Atari retro BBSing, named the endeavor, right, to restore and to preserve BBS history as the Southern Amos Projects.
Excellent. We'll get into the BBS aspect in just a minute here. I wanted to kind of first get some background on your experience with Antic. And so I'm wondering when you got your first Antic issue, or if you remember.
Yeah, my first issue was July 84, which was handed to me because there was an article from Sue Subek that was written based upon setting up, communications for the Atari AA. And there was quite a bit of mention around Amos and telecommunications and the broadening of Antic's involvement with promoting BBSs and Atari communications.
Oh, good. It's cool that you can remember that. I remember my first issue as well, and that would have been the August 83 issue. It had a number three, and I remember seeing it on we were on a trip with my grandparents and saw it in a little convenience store, and it had an Atari logo on it on a printer, and it was huge, took up the whole page, and when I saw it, I had to have it, so that was my first one.
Well, I mean, I always remembered Antic because I was more interested in the advertisements at first, and then I got into the coding side and enjoyed doing the type-in, right, of, you know, various games, especially utilities that were published. And they always had a really great setup right in the front where they referred to it as the I.O. segment, I believe, where they took user information, like, you know, readers. Anything right. That was related to fixing broken code that someone had found. I think our friend from Basement BBS, John Polka, has a mention for correcting something around an error in one of the basic programs that was built. And, you know, that part of it to me was Antic really paid attention quite a bit to their users.
Cool. When I run into the John Polka one, I will have to reach out to him. So did you ever subscribe to Antic, or did you just pick them up casually out that newsstand?
No, at first it was something that was just swapped between a few local SysOps and users. So, I mean, we used to do disk parties and things, right? Get together at someone's house and, you know, we start copying wares and, you know, swapping magazines and so on. But The first one that I got was at one of those get-togethers for SysOps, and then I was a subscriber. I remember it actually being something that was gifted to me. It must have been my grandparents or something getting me a subscription, and it was pretty substantial. I mean, most of the magazines, the ones that I recall, and I do have a stack sitting around somewhere, but you know, they were anywhere between 80 to 130 pages. It'd take up a good amount of time for somebody that's, you know, 12, 13 years old, something good to keep their attention. I think that's what I was told. It's good reading material for a young man.
Yep. So about when did you stop reading Antic?
I want to say about 88, 89. Compute became a little bit more easy to get my hands on. It was at any newsstand. I was working, you know, I think I was working in a mall, not that different than anybody else that was, you know, now 15, you know, 16 years old. And there was a Sam Goody across the way and they had a magazine rack and I would pick up Compute. There was a few others that I had grabbed, but Antic, that stack just never went away. It was always right next to the board when it was running.
Right. It looks like in the Antic issues that roughly every year they do a communications issue. Did you find the information in there valuable? I know you touched on it with the one question or with the one issue at the beginning here.
Yeah, before the 90s, you could almost count on it, right? Because especially around the telecommunication side, term programs. So when you go back and you look at, you know, their first introduction to 850 telecommunications, then 1030, there was one that was done on an auto dialer database. They even built software, or they had in the software library for Antic, various term programs, even for Kermit or VT100. They even started to build out, more and more opportunity for people to be able to use things like the XM 301, which was still a 300 baud modem, but there was terminal programs also for MPP, even connecting to CompuServe. There right. was a terminal emulator for that, and then HomePack. And then, you know, the big stuff started to come around Keith Ledbetter with 850 Express, 1030 Express first. And then MPP Express and those others. So it always held my interest. And there are a few things that I just recall, like about the dialers, that there was some basic code there that it would do various scans on repeated telephone numbers looking for modems.
The
I think
war
that
dialers.
One was called, yeah, the war dialers. And I think there was one that was called like CR Bust. And it was meant for that scanning purpose, but it was also something that you could, you know, use a little maliciously to crash a board. That, I believe, was back in 84 or so. But it was interesting because it was built in both BASIC and in Mac 65.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. Did you find any of the other articles that they had valuable?
You know, I wasn't a big gamer, and there was a lot of attention that was always paid to that segment of, you know, of reader. So, I mean, if you thought about Antic, one, you read a lot of articles, a lot of information that were half advertisements. So I learned about the Supra, you know, hard drive. I learned about, you know, moving into the ST world, about that hardware. And then some of the projects that came with it. There was I recall the ability to be able to build a board off of an 8-bit SIO cable that worked with Talking Typewriter. I don't know if you remember that software, but it was sort of the first, you know, voice use on the ST between user input, and they ultimately made one for the 8-bit side as well, which was interesting because it was, you know, word processor that, you know, had a bit of a voice. But the schematic and taking apart a cable and building a little micro board to connect it with the ST, that was always interesting. Any kind of little project work like that, especially the code side, I must have done at least 30 of those, you know, basic code input projects. So over that period of time, I was constantly looking at and trying to fix, because, you know, typos are a common problem with the Antic input.
Right, right. I've definitely seen that in the first issues here. So moving on, I guess, out of the Antic realm and more into the communications realm, when did you get your first modem, and do you remember what it was?
Yeah, my first modem was a 1030, and that was about 83, 84. And, you know, that immediately is dialing up boards and the ability to be able to download software, especially be able to download another BBS program. We downloaded FastAmus, and then from there, you know, built a ring detector from the schematic that was available. That actually came as part of the documentation for the first versions of Amos. And from there, you know, just continued to learn code. And that's what taught me code, was BBSing.
Very good. How long did you use your 8-bit for BBSing and not necessarily running the board, but just, you know, calling boards and things?
Yeah, for up until about 92, where you know, I had switched also to 1040 ST, but took a pretty long break there until I found SyncTerm, which made it pretty easy to get online. But no, I got to say, for most of my teen years, I was BBSing or I was on a board. Even if I, you know, I got down to just calling one local BBS, I was always, you know, not too far away from that hardware until we swapped it all out.
So you mentioned you at least used the ST platform. And I'm going to guess on this next one that the 8-bit was probably your favorite, but that could be different. And you may have used other platforms as well. What statement is true?
The 8-bit side, always. I felt that Atari's diversity, especially with BASIC XL and BASIC XE from OSS, really made it a very powerful tool, especially to be able to compete with speed. And you didn't need to know how to do machine language or assembly, right? If you wanted to learn how to do, you know, Mac 65, or you know, you wanted to expand your knowledge into other languages, CP, you know, M and so on, you had that ability. But the platform in itself, what you know, I found most intriguing is it didn't take a whole lot of understanding of BASIC as much as it took a whole lot of understanding of logic. And once you started to, you know, create the idea, I mean, we did things that, you know, rolling slot machines and, you know, don't forget ATASCII tunes, right. You know, video poker and, you know, online games like blackjack and all that, to build those things with such a, you know, a lack of real education in coding really came from common sense and a lot of practical thinking.
Right. Did you use any other modems besides the 1030? Did you ever upgrade to any?
Yeah, we did. So we rolled through the 1030 pretty quick. We had the MPP, the blue box, and that was a big departure from having to have a ring detector. Right. And then from there, jumped up to the Avtex, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
Avtex, yeah. 1200 and then 2400. And I don't believe I ever ran a board at 96 until, you know, the last 4 years. But the 2400 baud modem was interesting because we had ordered it COD, and my brother just reminded me of this like a couple of weeks ago. And when the UPS driver came, we were like short something on like maybe the tax or whatever it may be. And we had to keep him there and run down the street to a neighbor's house and go in, get the extra cash so that they didn't leave with the modem. And we got it online and we got the BBS running at 2400 baud, you know, that same day.
Nice. So out of all the modems that you tried, which one was your favorite?
You know, actually, my favorite modem is not a dial-up modem. It's actually the Y modem, you know, Jim Drew. And yeah. It's it acts, it behaves, and it you know, basically, you know, connects just like a modem or a dial up, you know, obviously through Telnet. But I found most Hayes modems to be pretty much the same. I was never a big fan of, you know, the dip switch settings and, you know, the various configurations and sharing a Hayes modem, say for example, with a, you know, a PC. I felt like things that were built for Atari that were made for Atari were always great. Like the SX212, I've got one of those and I still do some dial up every now and then. And I find that, you know, connecting it through SIO and not even having to use the 850 is just, you know, a brilliant way of, you know, Atari, you know, adapting to greater speed.
Right. So what is your favorite terminal software for the actual physical hardware?
Yeah, for physical hardware, I got to say that it's a modem. And I know that there'll be a few people that cringe about that and saying, well, you know, you got 850 Express, you got the Express cart, you know, you got Bob Term and so on. But there was always something about calling a basic. Like when you knew you were calling Amos or you were calling Forum or you're calling Karina or Nightlight and you were using, you know, like Jim Steinbrecher's, you know, terminal program, which, you know, ultimately, right, was improved by Matt Singer. But using a basic terminal program and using that, again, their ability to be able to take BASIC and to be able to get it to move at, you know, 1200 and 2400 baud with a buffer X modem from Ward and, you know, all the features that were rich in those term programs was just amazing. And so, yeah, you know, assembly, machine language, right? And, you know, even, you know, going broader, I always felt like a BASIC term program calling a BBS that was built in BASIC was just a better experience.
Yeah, I used the heck out of a modem when I was younger.
It was hard not to because it Antic promoted it like crazy.
Yes.
And you got the firm understanding from typing in the code at first, right? If you were building it yourself, you got the firm understanding about how it all worked, you know, things from polling and, you know, the XIO commands, and all of the deeper knowledge that, you know, the universe brought to us in
right.
the form of understanding telecommunications.
Right. So when did you first decide to start a bulletin board?
Yeah, so it was 83, 84, and it was right after our first experience in calling a local bulletin board that was in the 516 area code that was the bandits' hideout. And Sean Cullen was the CISOP. And, you know, avid coder, big fan and, you know, friend of Matt Singer, was running for him and had customized it, you know, beyond belief. And the Itasky screens were amazing. It was themed out really well, but it was the place where you went to go get wares. And, you know, being in the same town, literally, you know, 10 minutes away from Sean's house, it was hard not to get involved. And then once, you know, you get involved with one person, we were involved with many others. And it, you know, from there, it became a decision of, we're going to run Amos. Sean's running Forum. Everybody else is running Amos, but we got it. We understand it. And then once we did that and we brought it up, we started meeting other CISOPs. And then we started between Southern Amos, South of the Border, and another board called Wet and Wild. We started the projects that were basically around Southern Amos, which would become, you know, a highly modified version of Amos that was built out by four of us. We met, you know, online as kids, of course, and then we met at the mall and, you know, went to somebody's house. We went to Neil Griffin, who ran Wet and Wild. We went to his house and we'd code for hours and, you know, hours and days and days, and finally came up with a package that was incredibly foreign to what original Amos was. And by putting together all of this brain trust, we built out some of the most extensive coding projects for the Amos side that I could have ever imagined. Even to this day, when I look at that code, it's absolutely astonishing to me that a bunch of 11 to 14-year-olds did this.
Do you remember the name of
the BBS?
Yeah, the BBS, yes.
Yeah, the first BBS was Southern Comfort. So it was trying to stay within the same theme of Southern Amos as the core. South of the Border was really the main hub, even though that Neil was a little bit of the ringleader over at Wet n' Wild. South of the Border had all the hardware. He had everything, you know, including, you know, like three super drives, every gadget you can imagine, Rambos, the whole thing decked out, and was a great place to experiment because of the processing power.
How many users did you achieve?
We were seeing anywhere between 30 to 60 a day at its high point. I can't remember exactly how many users we ultimately had, but the 516 area code really only existed of about 15 boards, but plenty of users. It seemed almost unlimited. And then we had gotten some really good recognition from Newsday about the bulletin boards, and that was the local newspaper. And it really, from there, it was all, you know, three Southern Amos boards were always constantly busy. And it was, you know, one user at a time.
And that's the dream, right?
Right.
So with all the activity around the boards then compared to the boards now, what's the relative difference in the volume?
Yeah, I would first go to the message bases on that, because the message bases were nonstop. Everyone understood that this was the place where, you know, we were defining basically what social media is today.
Right.
This was a place where we invented a little bit of, you know, cyberbullying. So, you know, things never really got out of hand. They were pretty funny. You had to be very witty and on your toes.
Right.
And you had to be good at spelling, which, you know, wasn't necessarily always my strong suit. But, you know, first and foremost, it was the place where you had the ability to be able to solve complex problems. And that still holds true today. But in the message bases, we could turn over 100 messages inside of the database. We could turn that over within 3 days. And it was just amazing the amount of commentary that was going on. I wish I still had some of the, you know, some of those message bases, because there was a lot that was relevant to, again, solving bigger problems or innovations that were being built on the side of, you know, Amos and coding. But also, SysOps would love to advertise on the most busiest boards, and the ASCII work that was done was outstanding.
Right, right. Those screens are great to look at. So from the original Southern Comfort board that you ran, do you remember what the hardware details were?
Yeah, 800XL, pretty much stock. Again, with a 1030 to an MPP to an Avtex 1200 to a Avtex 2400. There were 4 1050 drives.
Wow.
That did most of the work. And then that moved up to a 130XE, and the RAM disk was used for wares and so on. We never had the hard disk side. We had to make do with a lot of creative work on the disk side. But the cool thing that I remember about this board was, or the setup was, we had this really big Philips TV that had the ability, it was a monitor, but it had the ability to go from color to green screen to amber. So while you were burning your eyes, right, and coding through this, you could always change up the, you know, the color scheme, almost like get an IBM look, right? The old AS400 view. Yeah. on a dummy terminal.
Nice.
And then there were the printers.
Oh, right, because you got to keep the log of who's called.
Right. Can't run that on a disk. So there was always a plotter printer, because that was my favorite on the, you know, on the 1020. And we used a Gemini 10X as the, you know, the green bar roller, right, that just went on and on all day and all night with the logs and any errors that were occurring on the board.
That little printer is the printer that I had when I had my Atari back in the day, and that thing was a workhorse tank.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, so what prompted you to start the software restoration project?
I was bored during the pandemic, and I was still playing around with the emulators for a couple of years. I was using them to dial out with Bob Term and calling a few of the boards that had still been online. Basement was there, Boot Factory, Alcatraz, Dark Force, and Starfleet headquarters. So I was still dialing out. And then I started looking around at, you know, the software that I had and converting that over into ATRs. And I came across Amos on one of my disks. I believe it was the MPP version. And started just checking. And everybody was running the same platform, right? They're all running BBS Express Pro, and no Amos, no Nightlight, you know, not seeing the light of day. And then all the other programs that, you know, you just started searching around and you started finding and, you know, looking at basically about 10 restorations that have been completed, including Forum, right? Of course, Amos, ESP, Atari Link, Night Shift, Hutch, BBS, you know, a couple of others. Because what was broken about them was people had stopped working on them. So changes and, you know, attempted enhancements, or even original, right, you know, untouched code, but needed to be modified and needed to be brought a little bit current, either to work with an emulator or with a Wii modem, or, you know, even real hardware, however. So, you know, I just, when I started rebuilding Amos and bringing that back up, it just made sense because everything was a derivative work, essentially, in BASIC of Amos. So doing Forum was pretty easy. You know, moving forward into some of the other programs, again, just made sense. And then there was a community that was built around it, and it And people wanted to, whether they wanted to run it or just have it, it didn't matter. But having a working version that they could load up on Altera or that they could load up on, you know, Atari 8X, you know, and take a run at revisiting a BBS was interesting to me.
Yes. Yeah. So you mentioned that there were about 10 that are restored. Do you know how many of those are actually running current boards today?
Well, so Amos XE is up and Forum XL is running. And then you've got Forum XE Professional. And then Nightlight is running. The others, which are basically some of the derivatives, aren't working. But one of the Antic products or collaborations, I should say, which is Bulletin Board Construction Set, is running today, which is interesting because it always had such a negative reputation for crashing, but is still running.
Right. So what keeps you interested in BBSs then and actually now, since it's more relevant?
Yeah, I mean, it's the creative side. I'm good at crafting Atascii screens. I like preserving, you know, not just for nostalgia, but, you know, for our Atari history. What I think was a very innovative period in time for most of us that, you know, were growing up around, you know, the Atari BBS community. I restore and host the Atari Tunes, which most of them were built by Tim. That, you know, are extraordinarily labor intensive to build. And, you know, Josh Renau with, you know, Break Into Chat has done a good job of working and, you know, saving those things from his side as well. So there's people with a lot of commonality around restoring, preserving, and sharing, right? All of this media that could easily have disappeared with people just shoveling floppy disks into the trash, or not paying attention to those things that were historically important to the retro, well, important now to the retro community.
Okay, excellent. You mentioned that, you're good at generating Atascii art, and I'll have to agree that you got some really excellent screens on Southern Amos. And, you know, the intro screens in particular and the exit screens, they've got even Atascii animation included in them. So I got to commend you on your efforts there. Do you want to mention what you use to create those?
Yeah, I use LaBrake, and I also use the editor for Panther. Don't ask me the authors, can't remember it.
Okay.
time period, I think for both of them, is around 86, 87. Panther was a little less used by SciSops. LaBrake and TexPro were heavily used by most SciSops. LaBrake just happened to be the easiest to use, the easiest to edit if you made a mistake. And it's easy to make a mistake when you're tracking every cursor movement, every little widget and every little design element, and going back 100 paces, should be easy. But don't forget, we're talking about an Atari A8 editor. So copy and paste and things like that are not built into either one of these. But emulators help to take care of that today.
Right. I know you're working on a new BBS, and I don't want to spoil any details that I'm aware of. Do you want to share any of the target features or other details with anybody?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, this is a ground up project. And moved pretty quickly in the early start, right? You know, the basic modules that you need for a board, you know, input, output, modem routines, SciSop views, basic functionality, but have taken a bit of the modern as far as menus and how you navigate and simplified it, you know, away from the A, B, and C kind of menu functions to the 1, 2, 3. And breaking these things apart into what I refer to as the ladder. So this way, if you want to stay compartmentalized in a small part of the BBS, you don't need to go anywhere else. But if you want to expand and you want to explore, you've got the ladder that you can run up and down. The main features that are different from most of the projects or the BBS programs from our history is the editors and the message bases plus the user side of things, which is, you know, today you basically type with a word wrap. You know, the PC boards give you, a blank screen, a canvas, basically. You can go through as much as you want, up and down, left and right, do your error corrections. We're a bit limited in the old programs to, you know, message editors.
Right.
And, you know, that slash, you know, E and, you know, or, you know, hit enter on a empty line just seems like a step that's not required. So working through some of the logistics on how to stop recording keystrokes, meaning arrow keys and directions and things like that, taking that out of the message editor really opened it up that you get a canvas to be able to build your message on, both with a TASCII or ANSI capability to it, because you've got the ability to be able to convert these things through some, you know, very slick code. Also built into it is some things that are a little bit more modern that help to bring people a little bit more into the conversation. Obviously, you've always had reply before, but you know, now you can rank and rate, you know, the message. You could give it a thumbs up or an emoji, give it a counter, so that this way you could see how many people viewed the message, how many people liked the message, how many people replied to it, and make it a thread versus this ongoing, you know, routine of number of messages. So this way you don't have to hop back and forth like within, you know, some of the BBSs, you can jump, right? You go, this message is related, you know, number 238, jump back a little bit. Inside the thread, you get to control how much information you look at, how old you go back, how far you go back, how far you go forward.
Very nice. That'll be a lot easier to navigate.
Definitely.
Is there anything that I should have asked you and I didn't?
No, I actually think you did a really good job with those few questions.
All right. Is there anything you would like to share with the listeners?
Yeah, you know, with the resurgence of BBSing through a couple of new innovations, obviously FujiNet is one of them, which makes it very easy for anybody that's utilizing new, you know, old hardware or even new hardware with FujiNet PC. It gives you the ability to be able to call a board. Also, with the applications that are available on Mac, such as Muffin Term, which is outstanding both for an iPad, iOS, and OS X, the ability to be able to dial into a bulletin board and to support the people that are keeping this moving and keeping this alive. And as a community, right, take the time to regularly dial into a board. This is a lot of hard work. It's a lot of value that's delivered for it. And it is the like-minded community that you're looking for that doesn't have all of those negative connotations around, you know, politics and things that, you know, you can handle in your regular social media. This is like-minded people coming together and sharing parts about Atari, retro computing, vintage computing, coding, right? New innovations, as well as their personal experiences and some funny stories, along with you being able to revisit the past. As a community, we're, you know, 30, 40 users at any given time within the, you know, 12, 13 boards that are constantly running under the Atari banner. Expand it. We've got over 3,000 FujiNets that are active and being used, and very few of them are being utilized for the, you know, the BBS community. I get it. Gaming's a lot of fun. BBSing, once you try it, once you settle into it, you've got a routine, you'll see it's just like working your email every now and then and getting a really funny message or building a relationship online with people, like I said, that are like-minded and that are sharing good information with people that are interested in the same topic.
I agree, and I'm glad you brought up the FujiNet and the Muffin Term specifically. Those are both fine products. I often wonder if some of the reason why you don't see more callers is because the people that have the FujiNets just aren't aware that they can actually run these old terminal software programs and talk to old Atari bulletin boards.
Yeah, I agree. And so we've set up a lot of videos and a lot of online information. SouthernAmis.com has all the tutorials, all the videos, step-by-step instructions written out, live videos that take you through it step-by-step. Couldn't make it easier for someone to get back into BBSing and really enjoy revisiting the past, hopefully, and seeing some of these works that are being preserved.
Right. And I can attest from the last year and a half, roughly, that I've been back in the BBS community that it's been a lot of fun.
For me, too.
All right, Rob, thanks for your time and for sharing all your information. I will see you around on the boards, and maybe we'll see some new users after this airs as well.
Thank you, Wade.
I received some feedback pretty rapidly after the first episodes released. From Richard H., quote, "I enjoyed the podcast, and I do hope you continue. Your commentary is highly appreciated. It brings back fond memories and has stirred my interest in my Atari 8-bit machines. I've quite the collection, which I haven't used for many years, but now fully intend to bring them out and put them to use. Again, thank you for your podcast." End quote. Thank you, Richard, for the kind words and taking the time to give me some feedback. I really appreciate it. The next feedback is from Randall Kendig of the Antic Podcast and Floppy Days Podcast. He writes, "Hi, Wade. Congrats on the new podcast, sir. Sounds very interesting. Just missed your announcement of this as we recorded Antic today, so we'll mention on the next one." Thanks, Randy. I appreciate any announcement you make, whenever it may be. By the way, keep up the great work on the podcast.
You did not tell him that. I said hello.
Other feedback I received was via the Basement BBS. Fitting, considering this is a communications episode. From John Polka, who writes, "Love the idea, I will check it out. I actually thought this was the idea behind the Antic A8 podcast until I listened to it for the first time. Glad someone's doing this." Thanks, JP. The Antic A8 podcast is a great podcast in its own right, and part of the inspiration on why I started Inverse and Tasky to begin with. And there was a follow-up message to that one from Amos, who writes, "Funny you said that. I thought the same thing when first finding out about the Antic podcast, but nothing about Antic. Still a great podcast. Smiley face emoji. Anyway, Wade's passion for this project and the quality, besides this is an awesome topic, is outstanding. I hope everyone provides some feedback to keep it going." Thanks, Amos. Indeed, this has been a fun project so far, and I have really been enjoying the research aspect. It has me using the A8 more and remembering things that have long since been filed away in dusty places in the back of my mind. Atari 8 Guy also sent a message on the Basement BBS and writes, "I enjoyed it. I hope you keep doing them. I plan on reading along with the podcast. I didn't really get into Antic until 87, so it'll be nice to live the glory years. Thank you. I had originally planned 3 episodes as a test, and I've bumped that up to 6 based on feedback now. If you enjoy the podcast, let me know. I was actually kind of impressed. I got responses on BBSs, and I think that's pretty cool." And I also got some feedback on Mastodon. Rob from Player Missile writes, "Just listened to episode 1 of the Antic Files. Loved it. Looking forward to more. Thanks for the mention on the magazine grid as well. Glad it is useful. Because it took a lot of Python to generate." Happy face emoji. "Thank you, Rob, for your excellent research and deep dives. Your podcast is excellent and very much missed. And I'm hoping you return soon. I'm also glad this isn't a you mad, bro, moment for me." Remember, if you have any stories related to Antic Magazine or any first-hand experience with any of the products mentioned, I'd like to hear about it. My contact information is on the Inverse Atasky website. Some thanks are in order, and first, I'd like to thank Zane Little for the track "The Cool Factor" from the album Another Bag of Chips, which is used in the opening sequence. Next, I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting my endeavors in this project.